women are so ingrained to basically give away their authority to the people around them. And so I think that's the beginning of all of it. I think it really fosters disconnection. It fosters disconnection from mother and baby.
Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Fallon, and my co-host Corey and I were so honored to sit down with the lovely Taylor Kulik today to discuss how we can support biologically appropriate infant sleep and honor mom's rest needs in the process. Today, we're going to dive into holistically supporting your sleep and offer really practical tips to help foster rest in your home, even as a new mom. We cover several factors that play into a new baby's sleep, and as usual, are asking the question, what is biologically normal for this topic? How did moms and babies historically handle sleep? And what we want you to know is that while we will offer sleep training alternatives, this episode is in no way an anti-sleep training episode. Rather, it's a way to offer information that moms might not be receiving from their children's primary care providers, because we want to help empower you as a mom while fostering a safe place for your baby to rest. Now, it's no secret that what we eat during the day has the opportunity to greatly affect sleep. And if you've been a listener for a while, I'm sure you're familiar with this idea that night wakings for mom can often come back to her nourishment. Our liver, for example, can only store so much glycogen throughout the night, and we often need a pre-bed snack to help support those energy levels, as well as making sure we're eating enough nutrient-dense foods throughout the day. And then we can use small steps like cutting off caffeine after a certain point of day. You guys probably know that we love our coffee around here. I would never wish any new mom to go without it, but we can approach it wisely. So drinking it after our breakfast or with our breakfast, never as our first form of food or drink for the day. We can use it as a morning stimulant instead of relying on it throughout the day. And then, of course, we want to prioritize quality coffee. We are fortunate to have my all-time favorite coffee brand, Purity Coffee, sponsoring today's episode. And I always tell people that Purity is the coffee that allowed me to drink coffee again. If you've heard my story, you know that I was coffee-free for about 5 years because I just could not tolerate it well. And it turns out what I really needed was to drink it in a metabolically supportive way, which includes having enough nourishment before I consume it and consistently in my life, adding a good quality fat and carb like raw cream and maple syrup. And then I want to use coffee that has been mold tested and is organic. There's a lot of organic coffee on the market, but testing for mold and mycotoxins is something Purity Coffee is really spearheading. The truth is coffee is a really common sneaky source of mold. And I find that drinking Purity's coffee eliminated any sort of digestive upset I experienced, as well as putting in those nutritional foundations. And because we love both coffee and you guys so much, new customers can use the code FREELYROOTED30 to save 30% on your Purity coffee order. All right, I hope you guys have your mold-free, sweet and creamy coffee in hand and are ready for an amazing episode on baby sleep.
All right, welcome to the show, Taylor. We have actually wanted to have you on since season one to do this episode. This is such an important conversation, and I know that both Fallon and I have loved following you and supporting you and just your mission for moms for years now. And I actually had you on my blog back in, I guess it was 2018 or 2019, when I was still somewhat of a new mom and I didn't know, I resonated with your page so much because looking back into my newborn stage of becoming a mom for the first time, I didn't have education tools for co-sleeping. I thought co-sleeping, the only way to do it was to put a baby in like a bassinet next to you. And I didn't understand why that wasn't, quote, like working for me. And so out of sleep deprivation, I think I remember Googling like, can you die of sleep deprivation? And that's where I was at around like 4 weeks postpartum. And I found a blog that talked about bed sharing and like breast sleeping. And I was like, what is this? Like, how have I never heard of this? And that is essentially like your heart behind what you do is giving parents education when it comes to all of their options. But especially ones that honor biological needs of children and mothers, because the honest truth is that a lot of moms and parents are withheld that information. And so you have this platform where you educate people on that. And I would love to hear, and I'm sure our whole audience would love to hear, how you even found yourself into this topic. I know from my understanding, I think it was your own personal experience through your first child, right?
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me on here. I'm honored. I love you guys. I follow you guys. I'm so happy to be here. So yeah, almost
5 years ago. My daughter is crazy. She is almost five. And when she was born, you know, I had all of these ideas about how she was supposed to be sleeping. And I read all of the mommy blogs and the sleep blogs, and I didn't read any books, but I got the gists of all of the sleep training books and stuff from all of my Googling. And her, the first few months weren't horrible. Like, we were kind of in that stage where she would nurse to sleep, nurse right to sleep, and I could lay her down in the crib or the bassinet for the most part, like at night, not for naps. But then at around, you know, 4 or 5 months old or so, as many parents experience, her sleep just got progressively worse, and she was distracted. And she, now I had to rock her to sleep all of a sudden. And anytime I laid her down, she would wake up immediately. And I just, you know, for nighttime specifically, we weren't getting any sleep. We had her pack and play like at the foot of the bed. And every time I tried to transfer her, she would wake up. And we reached a point where my husband was just like, bring her into bed with us, because I was nursing her in bed a lot of the time, sideline nursing her in bed. And sometimes I would doze off, but she would always fall right asleep nursing in bed. And then I would wake up and I'd run to the, like run her to the crib and, you know, put her in there because I thought I had to. But she would sleep in bed next to me perfectly. And so my husband told me, just put her in bed with us. And I said, no, I can't do that. I'm a healthcare professional. I've been taught so many times that bed sharing kills babies and it's so dangerous, yada, yada. But we did. We finally did, because my husband needed to get some sleep. He had to go to work in the morning. I needed to get some sleep. And we all slept a lot better. And also, like, the naps for her were always a struggle. And I remember, like, have vivid memories of just sitting in her dark nursery, because I thought I was supposed to lay her down drowsy but awake, right? And she was supposed to, I couldn't nurse her to sleep. I had to, like, she had to lay down in her crib and put herself to sleep by herself, because for some reason nursing to sleep is bad, right? Mm-hmm. And so I remember spending hours in her room, in her dark nursery during the day, so depressed, because I would spend 2 hours trying to get her down for a nap and she would only nap for 30 minutes, and just like watching the clock waiting for my husband to get home. So anyways, fast forward to, I started looking into bed sharing information, and I realized that there were actually a lot of parents bed sharing, and there's a lot of information on bed sharing. And so I found the work of like Professor James McKenna, and he has tons of work on safe bed sharing. He researches the mother-baby dyad. He researches breast sleeping. So his website is just a great resource. And I was just like, what? Like you, what? There are people that are doing this and nobody has ever told me. And it literally changed my life, because that's also when I got really passionate about, around all of the same time, I was kind of trying to shift my career as an occupational therapist into supporting women postpartum. I dabbled in pelvic floor therapy. Like, I was really wanting to support women holistically postpartum, but I became so passionate about sleep and educating parents about biological sleep and safe bed sharing and letting, like you said, letting them know their options, that I really just kind of, that's what I dove into. And so that's kind of all how it unfolded. Yeah. That's why I'm here.
I love hearing that journey, because it feels like so many of us really do shift our perspective over the course of parenting. I feel like I know fewer mothers who just started from day one with all of these like fantastic approaches and they still stand behind what they're doing like 5 or 10 yeah. years later. And that's just the truth, I think, of parenting, is that we just kind of, some of it we learn as we go. And I feel like I see my own journey so much in your story. I think you might've been one of the very first people, Taylor, to introduce me to this idea that sleep training might not be necessary or helpful. And in hindsight, you know, my first son is 8 now. So, you know, 8 years ago, we just dove fully into sleep training and it was miserable. It was like, mm-hmm. I hated every time he cried. We went like full on cry it out with my first son. And I was miserable the whole time. I hated mm-hmm. it the whole time. I remember those same feelings of like, he won't go down for a nap. And I remember feeling shame whenever he would fall asleep in bed with me. With my second son too, who was born about 18 months after my first, I remember feeling so much shame whenever I nursed him to sleep or whenever he fell asleep in bed with me. And then with my third, I feel like we've really pivoted and done kind of the more biological approach. And it's been beautiful. And fun story, guys, my toddler, who's 2.5 now, feel safe enough. I know you talk about this so much in your course, Taylor, but he feels safe enough now that he's been supported for all of his 2.5 years that he actually
Like I can tell him good night in bed and he is starting to just be like, okay, mommy, and he'll go to sleep because he had that foundation set for him that he was supported and he was responded to and he was cared for. So I really just, I love what you're doing. It's so important. I mean, literally I look at my own life and I feel like it's changed by this idea of supporting your kids' needs. Corey, I'm curious what your experience has been like with sleep. I know Taylor dove into hers a little bit, but I don't actually remember. Did you dive into biological sleep approaches with Koa out of the gate, or have you kind of shifted?
No, it was just that I completely shifted. My mom gave me the book, The Ministry of Parenting Your Baby, that old school one from Dr. Sears. It's really sweet. It just talks about the, you know, basically like attachment theory and like the seven B's, I think is his thing. And he isn't breast sleep one of the B's? Breast sleeping? Maybe it's just bed sharing or something like that. I don't want to misquote him, but I think that that book was the first thing that like awoken these, I guess, put on paper things that I felt intrinsically, but didn't understand how to put it into words. And I was like, oh my gosh, this makes so much sense that we live in a society where children are, for whatever reason, seen as this, like they need to be independent and resilient. And so let's force them into that instead of, oh wait, that comes as a result of attunement and attachment and responsiveness. And anyway, so I was always like, you know, 100% on board with the whole co-sleeping thing, especially or ever since he was born, but I just didn't understand like what it actually meant. And then when we started bed sharing at 4 weeks postpartum, I'll never forget going to sleep that night and then waking up the next morning feeling like a completely different human. Like I had actually entered another person's body that was actually thriving and well rested, and like nothing, I've changed nothing since then because it's what works for our family. It's been incredible. He was ready to transition out of our bed at age 3 before my daughter was born. And then my daughter, she just went, I mean, she was home birth and then we went right into bed. Like that is exactly what the transition was. And it's incredible to me seeing just how much more ease has come with that. And just her sleep is kind of like a, it's not on the forefront of my mind like it was with my son. I relate so much to your story, Taylor, with the whole nap thing of just like, why is he not napping independently? And like, just why can't I just lay him down in the crib? Why is he waking up every time? And that whole idea of like being in a dark nursery with a crib and trying to like force something on my child and me going insane. Like it's both parties are kind of, you know, going insane at the same time. But yeah, basically I would love to hear, you know, talking about the big picture of what is happening, how has the sleep training industry created a problem and then created a solution to that problem?
Yeah. So, you know, Fallon, I think you hit the nail on the head earlier when you were talking about how you had so much shame when you would breastfeed your baby to sleep or if they were in bed with you. And I felt the same. You know, everything I did, it's so shame-inducing when you have so many external voices telling you that what you're doing is wrong, what you're doing isn't okay, what you're doing is going to ruin your child, or you're not helping them develop appropriate sleep habits or whatever it is that people are saying to you, including doctors, right? Which parents trust. Most parents trust their healthcare providers and they're the ones saying this. So of course they're going to listen to them. So, you know, basically what has happened is that really a group of old men years and years ago created the idea of, and when we're talking about sleep training, we're talking about separation-based, I'm mostly talking about separation-based sleep training. So any form of sleep training, because there's so many definitions of sleep training, right? Any form of sleep training that limits responsiveness to a child to meet an end goal. And usually that end goal is to get them to stop crying or signaling, because crying is their way of signaling. I also just want to give a disclaimer too before we dive into this. This is a part that I left out of kind of my journey with sleep, but I did try to sleep train my first child as well. So I have all of the compassion and empathy and understanding for parents who feel like that might be the only way, who might want to sleep train. I totally get that. I felt like I had to sleep train and I tried it. And like you, Fallon, I was miserable. We didn't last very long. Like I could only listen to her cry for 5 or 10 minutes. And there's a reason for that, right? That's how we're designed. I don't judge parents who sleep train. I just think it's so important to talk about this and for parents to know what sleep training is and how it works and what it's doing, and that it doesn't have to happen, because we're sold this message of you have to sleep train. It's the only way. It's almost sold as this rite of passage for a baby or a child. And it's not. So I think parents just really need to know that. So back to what I was saying. Some old men created separation-based sleep training, basically, and it's rooted in behaviorism. So we're just simply trying to modify the behavior. We're not paying attention to necessarily like what is the reason behind the signaling or the crying or the wanting to be near parents. And then what happens, it's almost like this cycle, right? Because there's a lot of, you know, sleep trainers out there and language out there, and it's infiltrated our culture so much that even, like I said, doctors are telling parents they have to sleep train, or you have to stop nursing your baby to sleep, or you have to set them down in their crib awake and let them fall asleep by themselves. And so it's infiltrated our culture so much that it's become so normalized. And it's really just a bunch of like marketing. It's shaming parents, like making parents literally feel shame for using their body to support their child, for rocking, for nursing. And so of course, when parents feel shame and they feel like they're doing something wrong because they've been told they're doing something wrong, and they've been told that it's not enough for them to use their body, they have to get their baby to fall asleep in the snoo or have the pacifier. That's okay, but it's not okay to nurse to sleep or rock your baby to sleep, right? So anyways, it's all of these messages that really just create this fear in parents and shame, and that fear and shame combined just make parents feel like they have to do something. And so basically, I feel like I'm not making my point clearly.
So this is beautifully said.
They've created the problem. Okay, good. They've created the problem because they are telling us that everything that babies do normally and naturally is a problem. Basically, natural baby behavior, developmentally appropriate baby behavior is a problem. They've pathologized that, this is what I like to say, because and when you go to the doctor, the first thing they ask you is how is baby sleeping or where is baby sleeping? And it's just not the case that the majority of babies have a sleep problem, but they've kind of created this idea. And so if this is the problem, then what is the solution? And so then they sell the solution, which is separation-based sleep training.
Wow. Such a fantastic description and explanation. So if a parent or a mom is wanting to dive into more holistic sleep support, let's talk about that a little bit. Corey and I both really love the diagram of holistic sleep that you have put on your Instagram. It's a little support pyramid. We can link that post in the show notes. So I'm going to explain it since we can't actually visualize it as we're talking. So at the bottom of the pyramid, we have understanding and accepting biological sleep patterns and needs, creating realistic expectations from that. The next tier up is adjusting factors that we do have control over to optimize sleep and reduce excessive night wakings. And then finally, the top of the pyramid talks about shifting patterns of support. Can you walk us through those three sections a little bit more?
Yeah. So the bottom, I like to think of as those are the things that we really should, but that's the foundation of sleep, right? That's the foundation of not only sleep, but parents' perception of sleep, of baby sleep. And so those things have basically nothing to do with changing anything about baby. And that's really what I believe parents should focus on, because too often when we're talking about infant sleep, and parents are telling whoever they trust that they're sleep deprived, the solution is sleep train, change baby. But there's so much we can do before changing baby. And so those bottom things are, you know, those are things that, first of all, it's important that parents have an understanding and an acceptance of biological patterns and needs for their children. So most parents today have unrealistic expectations about infant sleep. They think their baby should be not waking at night or not feeding at night or napping for a really long time or able to be on a perfect schedule. And that's really just not developmentally appropriate for most babies. And so having the understanding of what sleep actually should and does look like, and it can look like a lot of things, but just having that basic understanding can be huge in shifting a mother's, a parent's mindset. Because if you're going into parenthood expecting your baby to sleep through the night by a young age or not feed at night or put themselves to sleep, and your baby isn't doing that, you're going to be resentful. You're going to be frustrated. You're going to be stressed, because again, it's this problem now that's been created, and you think that it needs to be fixed in some way, or you're doing something wrong, or there's something wrong with your baby. And so just shifting that, those expectations can be huge. Same with forming realistic goals, and then also implementing external supports for caregivers. So besides changing baby and how baby's sleeping, what can we do to support, specifically support mom, because many moms are breastfeeding, and they're the ones feeding their baby at night and up with their baby a lot of the night. So what external supports can we implement for mom to help her support her baby's needs? Not change baby's needs, because we can't change baby's needs, but we can support mom to meet baby's needs. So maybe that is just support. Someone steps in and helps with baby in ways that they can. Maybe it's dad. Maybe it's someone cooking mom meals, or cleaning her house, or doing the things that she feels like she needs to do, so that frees up some of her time to rest when she can and to care for baby. So that's kind of the bottom of the pyramid. I think that's like foundation, first steps that need to happen when we're talking about sleep with mom and baby. The next little part of that pyramid that going up is then changing or adjusting the factors that we have control over to optimize sleep. So if there are excessive wakes happening for baby, so if baby is really waking a lot and we want to see if we can reduce those wakes, there's still so much we can do that doesn't involve not responding to them. So there are so many factors that go into sleep. We have everything from daytime activity and nutrition and feeding, which is huge in those early days, especially with breastfeeding, ruling out any underlying medical issues that could be causing sleep issues, making sure the environment is set up right, you know, the optimal environment to facilitate sleep. There's so much that we can change, routines, making sure we're watching wake windows and learning baby's cues. All of those things are things that we can change. We have control over them. We can optimize those things, and that can lead to decreased wakes. And that, again, doesn't involve non-responsiveness. And then the very top tier is just shifting patterns of support. So this often comes when, usually for babies that are a little bit older or toddlers, when parents are doing certain patterns for their baby's sleep, supporting them in a certain way that just isn't working for that family for whatever reason anymore. So an example of this might be breastfeeding. It might be maybe a mom, just an example, maybe a mom is still breastfeeding an 18-month-old to sleep and breastfeeding them all night long. And maybe that mom does not want to breastfeed to sleep anymore or wants to start thinking about night weaning. Not that she has to night wean. There's nothing wrong with breastfeeding an 18-month-old to sleep. I still breastfeed my almost 2-year-old all throughout the night. But some moms for whatever reason need to make that change. And so shifting patterns is that very top layer where it is kind of more focusing on changing the support that we're offering our child, but we're still supporting the child in the ways that they need. So this might look like a mom moving from supporting with nursing to supporting with snuggling, or something like that. And so there are ways that we can do that respectfully, that honor the relationship. And a kind of a part of this pyramid, this top pyramid piece too, is specifically with older babies and toddlers. It's really also about focusing on the relationship between the caregiver and the child, focusing on their attachment needs, on connection, and filling their bucket to help them. Like you talked about earlier, Corey, allowing our child to deeply depend on us is how we facilitate independence when they are ready, when in their own time, when it's developmentally appropriate. And so focusing on that relationship and maybe setting some loving boundaries for toddlers, that's all kind of part of that top tier, helping us to shift patterns to figure out a way to approach sleep that is more sustainable and works better for our family.
So good. Yeah, there are so many things that you touched on that are all like these subtopics by itself. But I guess one I want to touch on, because you just mentioned it, is if you are brand new to establishing loving boundaries, and that's a new like conversation for you, because maybe that wasn't something that you've seen growing up demonstrated by your own parents or your own mom. I know that Caitlin Sapp, who we had on our podcast, and then also, I mean, I feel like you share a ton of resources when it comes to respectful parenting and gentle parenting and how to get plugged in to like your favorite resources there. By the way, do you have a favorite book on kind of this topic of like, you know, teaching our children boundaries and or I guess establishing boundaries in a respectful way with our kids?
That's a good question. So my very favorite book for younger kids is my parenting book for younger kids is Rest, Play, Grow by Deborah McNamara. And I haven't read it in a while, and I'm not positive that there, it talks about boundaries in there, but I think it does. I think it does. So that would be probably my first recommendation.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I think, I feel like mine would be Janet Lansbury's podcast, 'cause it's such like short bursts of like very practical examples of how to actually like implement boundaries and then how to respect a child's like protesting to that. And anyways, her podcast is called Unruffled, if you guys want to check it out. But yeah, I want to just talk about this support that we can show moms. And I think for a lot of people just learning, like, is our system even set up to support mothers right now? Is it even set up to support the mother-child dyad? And I think that is one of the reasons why, you know, sleep training has prevailed so much, because we in a moment of desperation, because we don't have that support, that's kind of what you are tempted to rely on. And you have defined sleep training on your page before, I thought so brilliantly, as an adaptive response or a coping mechanism to being in a broken system. So I would love to talk about just that broken system and basically like what your take is on the system right now and if it's supportive of the mother-child dyad.
Yeah. So no, it's not supportive. And I kind of want to back up, because I would not back up, but in terms of your question, how it's unsupportive, like from the beginning, when a woman gets pregnant, the system is set up. And when I'm talking about the system, I'm talking about the medical system, I'm talking about our culture, you know, just everything, society. But from the time a woman gets pregnant, like we're expected to be this passive participant in our pregnancy. Basically, we're basically told that we don't really have much control over outcomes. Like it doesn't matter really what we eat that much. It doesn't really matter how we move our body. Like we're just like, we go through the system, specifically if you're like within the medical system, the medicalized birthing system. So we're really set up from the beginning to not trust ourselves, not trust our bodies, really rely heavily on doctors, healthcare providers, and listen to everything they say. And then when we have a baby, it's no different. It's no different. We go to the pediatrician, you know, I don't know, a couple days after our baby's born, like every few months, we have to ask our doctor about everything. Like I'm always amazed, because I don't do this anymore, right? But when I was a new mom, but when I talk to new moms and like just, you know, mention something and they're like, oh, I need to ask my doctor about that. But it's like something that is not like a medical issue at all. It's like a lifestyle choice, like bed sharing or playing. I don't know, like a way to play. And I'm like, you don't have to ask your doctor that. You really don't. But it's just so, women are so ingrained to basically give away their authority to the people around them, to healthcare providers specifically. And so I think that's the beginning of all of it. I think it really fosters disconnection. It fosters disconnection from mother and baby. And then the whole culture, the whole system is set up that way, right? Pushing formula, the financial entanglements between formula companies and hospitals and doctors and all of this. It's really set up to push mothers and babies apart. And then we're told all of these kind of sleep training things. And also, don't hold your baby too much or you'll spoil them. You have to get them on a schedule. All of this stuff that only serves to further foster disconnection. And so when mothers are doing these things, they are literally becoming more disconnected from their baby, because they're not in attunement with their baby. They're not following their baby's lead. They're watching the clock for how often their baby needs to be fed. And so, I mean, the list just really goes on and on how the system is not supportive to the mother-baby diet. But then we, you know, on top of that, this lack of education about how babies actually should be sleeping and safe bed sharing and breastfeeding and all of that. I mean, it's really wild. It's really wild when you just stop to think about, you know, what is the year? It is 2022, right? And with the amount of miseducation, misinformation about breastfeeding, something as simple as breastfeeding from doctors, no less, from pediatricians, is astounding. Like the amount of I mean, I get messages every day from mothers who are told ridiculous, crazy, dangerous things from their doctors about breastfeeding. And I'm just like, really? Like, breastfeeding is one of the most natural things. Women have been doing it since the beginning of time. And we somehow we've lost that education. It's like it's almost like we're like regressive. Like we're a regressive society. We're regressing back to like, we're stupider than ever. It's crazy. But yeah, so I mean, and then on top of that, you have women that are going, that have to go back to work at 6 weeks or 8 weeks or 12 weeks. And that's normalized. It's not only like here in the States, you know, 12 weeks is quote unquote good, like a good amount of maternity leave for mothers. Other places in the world, I mean, they get a year, sometimes 2 years. And so, but that's normalized here. And I think a lot of people don't even see or think that that's too early for a woman to be separated from her baby. And then the lack of a village, you know, in other cultures around the world, a long, long time ago, and in cultures around the world, even now, this is still happening. Women, new mothers have a village around them. They have wise women in their family, their mothers, their grandmothers, their aunts, people that are helping them rest during the postpartum period, passing down wisdom about how to be a mother and then caring for them. So they're doing the chores, they're doing the cooking. Mothers in many other cultures around the world aren't expected to clean their house and cook meals for, you know, a week after they have a baby. And so mothers are being supported better, or they were, and they are still in some cultures around the world. And so sleep training wasn't as big of an issue because they had so much support and people that they could pass off the baby to and go take a nap. And in our culture, we don't, many of us don't really have that system or that supportive system anymore. We don't have a village. And so really it's hard. It's hard for mothers. And it's hard for me to talk about this sometimes because I acknowledge that reality for women. I acknowledge that some women do have to go back to work at 6, 8, 12 weeks. I acknowledge that some women don't have maybe family in their life that is helping them with their chores and helping them with the baby and giving them time to sleep. And so, you know, part of me, and I get told this all the time, well, this is the reality. And so we shouldn't be talking, we shouldn't be, you know, quote unquote, shaming moms about sleep training. But I don't agree. And I don't agree that we should be shaming anyone about anything. That's not what we're doing though. But we do need to talk about this because even though that is a reality, it doesn't negate the reality of what our babies need and what sleep training is and does. So it's really hard because what is the solution? I don't really know. I don't have a solution for our broken system and culture.
Mm. Yeah. I love that you touched. Go ahead, Corey.
I was just going to say, I was going to add one thing to it because this conversation is so important when it comes to all things, as far as the system that is our foundation, because it doesn't just manifest itself in, oh, baby has a quote sleep problem and I need to fix it with sleep training. It's like everything when it comes to us as mothers and our health. And like back when we did the episode with Noelle and discussed the topic of postpartum anxiety and postpartum depression, she made sure that she laid it all out there of like, hey, this is what it takes to support yourself as a new mom. And Fallon and I still get responses from that going, wait, how did I not even consider the fact that like leaving my child, you know, so newly postpartum was not even biologically appropriate to begin with. So like, no wonder I was having postpartum anxiety or like, you know, diagnosed myself or like, you know, I had a doctor diagnose me with that without actually addressing the foundation of it. And so it's crazy how much this pours out into everything, not even just the sleep training conversation. And it's so important that you just talked about all that.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. Cause I did leave that out. Mental health, you know, we're diagnosed, we have rampant mental health problems among new mothers. And what is the solution? It's usually medication or just counseling, which counseling is great. If you have a good counselor, counseling can be great. But again, like you're saying, what is the root cause of that? There's so much, it's so complex and women are not getting the support they need for that. And then I'm sure you've talked about this before too, but nutrition, you know, postpartum support and care in general is just absolutely abysmal here. I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy. And women are just not supported. They're not told how to nourish their body. They're not told how to nourish their body, especially for breastfeeding. And how does that play into sleep deprivation? That makes a huge difference in sleep deprivation too. So there's so much to it. You're totally right.
Mm-hmm. I do really want to go back to the concept of mom shame. I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, we want to be gracious in our conversations, but we also have to acknowledge that being presented with new information that challenges our way of thinking does not automatically mean somebody is trying to shame us, right? Like just because somebody has a different viewpoint and is presenting that doesn't mean they're trying to shame anyone else who believes otherwise. And I think that you've always been really gracious in this, Taylor, in your presentation of this, you know, through your platform. And I'm curious how you typically respond to criticisms that you are mom shaming, you know, if you're speaking about this big picture of infant sleep.
Yeah. So I really struggled with this when I first got started because I do not want to make anybody feel badly. My intent is certainly not to shame anybody. But what I realized is that this accusation of mom shaming is usually coming from maybe a place of doubt or insecurity. And we've all been there. I've been there. You know, sometimes I will be on Instagram and I'll see something like parenting related and I'll like get a little triggered, right? Like maybe it's something, maybe it's like about yelling at your kids. And I get a little bit triggered because that's something I'm really struggling with and working on. You know, I strive to be like a respectful parent, but I was raised in a very like ragey household. And so I'm reactive and I struggle with it and I'm not perfect. And so, you know, I might get a little bit triggered and feel a little bit shame from that post, but that poster, that person that created that post is not shaming me. And that's what I've kind of realized is that it's usually, you know, if you are feeling shame when you have information shared with you, I think it's a call for a little bit of self-reflection to figure out why you might be feeling like that. And we've all been there. But basically, yeah, like you said, education is not shaming. It is so, so important to have education, to have information so that you can make an informed choice. I fully believe that women, that mothers can make good choices when they're presented with good information. The problem is most parents, especially when it comes to sleep, but with a lot of things related to parenting, most parents are not presented with accurate, good information. They're presented with lies and just things that are false and ridiculous rules. And that is what I want to change. So we have to talk about the other side of it. I don't even really like to call it this aside because it's just the truth. It's just kind of facts and reality. But women have to have all of that information, well-rounded information, to be able to make the best choice for their family. And I totally acknowledge that some parents might have all of the information and still decide that sleep training, like they're weighing the risks, they're weighing the benefits of everything. And for them, they may still decide that sleep training is the best option for their family. And I say, like, all the power to you if you have all of the information and you still decide that what's best for your family. I'm not here to judge. I don't know you. It's not my place to judge you or validate your decisions, but we have to share the information. And you know what I'm so concerned with increasingly in our culture that I see so much on, mostly on social media, real life doesn't seem to be like this quite as much, but it's almost like people want, and this is about a variety of things. I'm sure y'all get this maybe like with nutrition and stuff sometimes too, like food shaming or whatever, like everything that is uncomfortable, everything that is not like the mainstream narrative, any criticism of any paradigm, system, et cetera, is shaming. And it's just a way to try to silence this viewpoint. It's just it's a way to silence it instead of just hashing it out in the open and having, you know, open, honest discourse about it. And I just, it worries me because if we continue to try to silence people that are saying things that we don't like to hear or that make us uncomfortable, we're not going to have anything left to talk about. We're not going to be able to change our minds. We're not going to be able to learn new information and grow. And that is so important, especially as parents. It's so important that we're always evaluating the choices that we're making and maybe trying to see if we can improve those things or if maybe we need to change what we're doing. I do that all the time. Like I do that all the time with parenting stuff. I'm like, is this really like the best way to approach this? And it's not easy. And it's never like a I've arrived kind of thing. I've arrived as the perfect parent. None of us have. And if you have, you probably have some more work to do that you need to think about. But yeah, we have to have open conversations about this. It's so important. And for, you know, for the people out there that think talking about the potential issues with sleep training, they think that's shaming. I would just say, you know, there is another half of us that feel very isolated and alone as parents who don't want to sleep train and who feel like we have no support and we're doing everything wrong because culture and everybody is telling us that what we're doing is wrong and that we need to sleep train. And so we have to be able to talk about it. You get to have your, you know, as the sleep kind of sleep training crew gets to have their supportive places on the internet that educate and inform. And we have to have that too. So that's kind of my thoughts on that. It's not shaming. Shaming is like, and I think a lot of people do actually need this kind of definition. Shaming is when you are attacking somebody's character. So shaming is like, you're a bad mom. And I don't believe this. I'm just giving examples. Shaming is, you're a bad mom for sleep training, or how could you sleep train, or you're so selfish. So we're attacking the character. That's never okay. I don't think that is ever okay in any scenario, because I think most parents are doing the best they can with the information that they have access to at any given time. But sharing education is not shaming. You may feel shame, but that doesn't mean that the person sharing that information is doing shaming.
Totally. Yeah, that's a really good point. And also, I mean, even just going back to the topic of doing the best that you can with the information that you have, Fallon and I talk a lot about the concept of capacity on this podcast, and just like, they could even have the information at their fingertips, but like literally not have the capacity to even process it because they're in a state of like survival and fight or flight. And it's actually nearly physiologically impossible to like be able to weigh the pros and cons and see things objectively. And so, yeah, we have a lot of grace for these conversations on this podcast. And so spinning it over to, you know, how a mom would move forward, can we talk about how basically like honoring the biological needs of mom and baby together lead to optimized sleep and wellness?
Yeah, I think there's so many ways. So first of all, going back to that piece about just understanding what biological infant sleep looks like. So understanding that babies are meant to wake and they're meant to feed throughout the night. And this is actually good and important and beneficial for their brain. It keeps them safe. It keeps them in light stages of sleep is where we want them. So first of all, I think just understanding that again makes a huge difference for mom, and it allows her to not be stressed about sleep as maybe she might be if she didn't have that information. And it allows her to kind of rest knowing that it's okay that her baby's waking. But also going back to bed sharing, you know, I definitely know that bed sharing isn't right for every family, every situation. But bed sharing really is an important solution to talk about for many situations if it does work for you. And I actually think that it is important for every new mother, regardless of whether you have plans to bed share, for every new mother to at least set up a safe bed sharing kind of setup. Whether that, like if you don't feel like it can be in your normal sleeping bed for whatever reason, maybe making like a little sleeping pallet on the floor in another room in the nursery or something, where if you need to, you can lay down with baby and nurse baby and fall asleep. Because what ends up happening when we are not being realistic about this bed sharing thing, and we're just being told don't bed share ever, and doctors are just saying this, is that women are, they're bed sharing. They're still bed sharing, but they don't know how to do it. They don't know that there's a safe way to do it. They don't know that it's not safe to fall asleep on the couch or in the chair. So women are doing everything they can to not fall asleep nursing their baby, sitting up in the chair or whatever, and then they're falling asleep, right? Because what we know about breastfeeding is that when you breastfeed, both mom and baby have hormones released that make them sleepy. And so it is the biological norm for babies and moms to sleep together while they're breastfeeding. And so we have to acknowledge that in order to move forward and support new moms. So setting up that safe bed sharing setup will help moms get more rest, because when they are feeling like they, even if you don't want a bed share and you're like trying to stay awake for nursing sessions, you're going to have a night where you just can't do it. And so you need to have that space set up, because it is going to be so much safer for you to go to that safe bed sharing setup and sideline nurse your baby if you can and fall asleep with them there, than it will be for you to fall asleep in the chair. Or I was falling asleep standing up, rocking my daughter, like, and in the chair, just everywhere. So unsafe. Just honoring those needs, understanding biology and physiology and why things are the way they are, I think just brings so much acceptance and calm and peace. And it really just gives, it kind of gives mom, I think, freedom, right? I think it gives you freedom to support your baby the way that you want to and need to, and love your baby and snuggle your baby. I missed out on so many snuggles and so much holding my first daughter, my first child, when she was a newborn, because I was so scared I was going to create bad habits that I did not want to let her nurse on me. And like, it makes me sad looking back. Like, I regret that so much. And I wish that I had had those moments with her, but I just didn't have very many because I was too afraid. And so I think setting, having mom have realistic expectations and understanding like this really just gives her freedom to enjoy motherhood. And yeah, did I answer that question? I think I got off on a tangent.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
I think that was great. And as a kind of follow-up question, I know this may vary a little bit by age, but you know, what are some things that we can pay attention to let us know that our baby has a normal sleep pattern and a normal number of night wakings? Because I think, you know, a lot of moms, because they're functioning off of this traditional sleep pattern focused methodology, that they're like, oh, if my baby's waking past, you know, I don't know, 5 months old, like they should be sleeping through the night. I remember it being like a competition with any baby that I've had. It's like, oh, my baby's 4 months and sleeping through the night. And that's just like motherhood culture right now.
Yeah.
And so moms feel like there's something wrong if their baby's still waking up. And so can you help kind of recalibrate our thought process around that? You know, what are normal numbers of night wakings, et cetera. And then what are some things that we can pay attention to that might show us, okay, maybe there is an underlying issue happening?
Yeah, great question. So like you said, there is a huge range of what is normal. Pretty much in the early days, almost everything is normal. But it is normal for babies and even toddlers to continue to wake at night every couple of hours, every few hours. It is normal for babies to feed throughout the night through a year old, even through like 2 years old sometimes. It doesn't mean you can't change it if you need to, but definitely the first year of life, totally normal for babies to nurse at night. This idea of babies should be sleeping through the night when they're 5 months old or 6 months old, or stop feeding at night when they're 6 months old. I have no idea where that came from. Like, people will literally just throw out arbitrary rules and numbers. When baby reaches 10 pounds, they don't need to feed at night, or when they're 6 months old, or when they've tripled their weight. Like, it's just crazy. There's literally nothing to support that. But again, you know, I like to always say here too, some babies aren't going to need night feeds. And so it's mostly important that you're following your baby's lead, following their cues. You might have a baby that only needs one feed a night in maybe the first couple, I would say like 2-3 months old. And then maybe they start needing more night feeds when they hit 6 months or 8 months or something like that. So that's also very normal for newborns to kind of sleep maybe a little bit better, have a little bit more consolidated sleep, maybe be easier to get back to sleep. And then when they get a little bit older, it actually can get worse. Research actually shows that, just like surveying lots of parents and how their babies are sleeping, from 4 to 12 months is when parents experience the most disruption in sleep. And that's because there's so much development happening during these times. And it could be in like bursts. You know, some people call these sleep regressions. I call them sleep progressions, but they don't always hit at those exact like month markers because there's so much else going on. Like, you could have teething or illness, or something stressful is happening, or baby starting solids or working on a new milestone. And sometimes those things can hit like back to back to back to back, so that it almost seems like you are in like a never ending 4 month long sleep progression. And so I don't like parents to like focus on the 6 month progression and the 10 month progression, because it might not fall around that time. But just know that it is normal for sleep. It's like a roller coaster. Sleep isn't linear. So it's normal for sleep to be good and then get worse, and then get a little bit better and then get worse again, throughout the first couple of years of life, really. And in terms of sleeping through the night, you know, I always just like to point out that none of us really sleep through the night for the most part. We all often maybe wake and just like turn and like adjust our blankets, or maybe we need a drink of water, or something like that. Like, we might just, it might just be like such a brief wake that we don't even notice, but we are mostly waking throughout the night. The difference with babies is that they need help to co-regulate, because they are not capable of self-regulation. And so that's totally normal. And this will get better as they get older. So even toddlers, research shows that toddlers, I think this survey was they were like between the ages of maybe 3 and 4. I can't remember the exact age, but it showed that on average, these toddlers were still waking about 4 times a night. So it is still very normal. That doesn't mean that they were signaling every time, like crying out to their parents. But some of the times they were. And so what we like to see and what we usually see as babies go into toddlerhood and toddlerhood goes into childhood is that children are needing less and less support to get themselves back to sleep and not signaling as much, but they are still waking. And I just want to point this out too. Even research shows, the good research with sleep training shows that babies who are sleep trained do not wake less than babies who are not sleep trained. I think that's really important because a lot of the sleep training research out there is very flawed and it's using parental report as a outcome measure only. And so what that means is that the parents are the ones saying my baby woke 1 time or 2 times last night. But we know that parent report is very, very inaccurate. First of all, second of all, the end goal of sleep training is to get baby to stop signaling, right? And so if that is successful, I'm using, you know, quotation marks for that, then we would expect baby not to signal to parent as much. But the problem with that is that when we're just using parental report, we don't actually know then how many times babies are waking and not signaling to their parent. So when sleep training studies use actigraphy, which is it's an objective outcome measure. It's like a sleep monitor. It monitors sleep basically. We find that there's really not much difference in how often sleep trained babies are working versus not. So I just think that's really important to know. Wow. Yeah. It's really interesting. Like, doesn't that change things? Like if you know that as a new parent, doesn't that change things for you? But most parents don't know that. So
for sure. Cause they're told that if your baby is waking at night, then they're going to lead to XYZ down the road and it's going to cause like brain development issues and just all this fear that moms like literally freak out because their child is not, quote, sleeping through the night at a certain point. But like you just said, it's not even that they're sleeping through the night. They're just responding less to you. And so, and that is the thing about nighttime parenting, nighttime responsiveness. I know that Raised Good, that blog, always talks about this, but they're like, nighttime parenting is like we've been convinced in our culture that like parenting just kind of turns off at night and like that's your space and your time. And like, actually leading to, I would love to ask you this question because it was a frequently asked question in my stories whenever I had asked my audience if they had a question for you. I'm curious if you come across a circumstance where a mom and a baby, a mother decides like, I want to bed share or breast sleep or co-sleep with my baby, but the husband, is pretty strong in his stance of, you know, babies do not belong in the bed with, you know, wives and husbands. And how do you answer that question in a respectful way of the husbands? How do you help moms navigate through that?
I think this is really hard because I know there are so many differing like beliefs about marriage. And I know there's like religious beliefs that come into play with that. And you know, my opinion is just that if a man struggles, first of all, I think that man needs education. I think that man needs to be very educated about biological norms and the relationship between specifically a breastfeeding mother and baby. And I think that, you know, it is one of a father's roles, especially during the postpartum period, to be supportive to the mother baby dyad. But he can't really know how to be supportive to that dyad unless he understands that dyad. But yeah, I would say, I talk about this sometimes, there's kind of this idea that bed sharing leads to marital struggles or bed sharing leads to reduced intimacy. I have a whole podcast episode on that on my podcast. But one of the things I think to keep in mind is that if this wasn't exactly your question, but it's related. If there are marriage issues that are being blamed on bed sharing, like maybe husband is blaming marital issues on bed sharing. I truly believe that that is just kind of like the needle that broke the, what is that saying?
The camel's back.
Yeah. That one. The straw, I was like, wait, that's not right. The straw that broke the camel's back. Because there are likely more other underlying issues going on that are actually causing the marital issues. Maybe it's husband is feeling like he's disconnected for some reason. Now that baby's here, he's having a hard time connecting. Maybe he feels like he's not getting enough bonding, connection, intimacy time with wife. And maybe there's some resentment from one, either mom or dad, wife or husband. So it's not usually just the bed sharing. And if it is just the bed sharing, I just would encourage dad to kind of think about if he is struggling with coping with not being in the same bed with his wife, whom he loves and wants to feel connected with, think about how an infant would cope with not being able to be in bed with his mom or her mom as an infant. You know what I mean? It's like, adults should be able to kind of deal with that, with some changes and with some things that are not perfect and ideal for some time. Babies can't deal with that because babies can't self-regulate.
Wow.
I think the point you made about just husband education is so far-reaching and so good because, you know, I think about actually a lot of different topics that I get, you know, questions from moms just saying like, hey, I am fully on board with this and my husband is not. And I feel like that's a really common denominator for any issue regarding parental decisions in general. And I think it's just to kind of cap off that conversation, I think it's just such a good reminder that like moms, you know, we are the gatekeepers of wellness in our home a lot of the time. And that's a really just admirable and amazing role to have. And so I think, you know, just exactly like you said, Taylor, pointing our husband to more education for whatever the issue is, you know, in this case, sleep is, right. just a fantastic way to loop him in, because I think a lot of moms carry this struggle of feeling like, okay, I'm on board with this certain topic, whatever that may be. And, you know, my husband is not so much. And, you know, if you're a mom listening and you're walking through something like that, first hear that, we feel for you. I think a lot of us are in this space where we feel like we fully have, you know, dove into some of these issues that our husbands are not quite there yet on. And I would just encourage you to keep fighting, you know, keep offering research and resources and hang in there because I know that that can get tough. Okay, moving on from that, I wanted to add that little tidbit in, but what are some other ways that we can holistically support restful sleep for baby and mom from your perspective, Taylor? You know, obviously Corey and I talk about the nutrition piece quite a bit, you know, in terms of getting enough nourishment, you know, getting light exposure, you know, all of those fantastic pieces. What can you add to that discussion in terms of, you know, making sure mom and baby get the best sleep possible, especially in those early days?
Yeah, I would love to answer that question, but I actually do want to go back and finish. I realized I didn't finish answering that question about like red flags and things to look out for. And I think this is so important. So I do want to answer that question. So in terms of, we kind of talked about what is normal for sleep, for baby sleep, but I do want to talk about what might not be normal and some things to look out for. So some of the things that I look for is a baby who is waking consistently every 1 to 2 hours and really not giving many longer stretches. Now, a caveat to that, because in a breast sleeping relationship, so a mom who is probably bed sharing and breastfeeding her baby on demand throughout the night, this can be a normal pattern, like baby kind of latching on and off all night long. And so I don't only look at frequency of night wakes, but I also look at quality of sleep and what that, and like what sleep looks like when baby is on top of or next to mom versus what sleep looks like in the crib. Because we might expect that if baby is sleeping in the crib and they're having a really hard time being away from mom, that baby might be waking more frequently and it might be more of a connection closeness issue where, and not like a medical issue. But then if baby is moved into bed next to mom, are they still waking every like hour, crying, fussing? And so I don't only look at frequency. I look at, again, quality. So is baby restless, uncomfortable? Are they screaming? Do they seem like they're in pain? Are they really hard to settle and get back to sleep? There's so many things to look at. Like you can just tell, like you can tell if your baby's uncomfortable. And most of us have experienced this because a lot of us have experienced, if even if we had a baby who didn't really have any underlying medical issues, we might have had times where our baby was teething and they were in a lot of pain that night, or maybe they were sick and really uncomfortable. And so we know, we can see when it's just like, it's just not right. And those sorts of things you can't do a whole lot about. It's just kind of have to get through those developmental stages and the illness. But if that's happening all the the time. It could be the result of something. And so some of the things that will cause this pain, uncomfortable disruption of sleep. It could be breathing issues. So it could be like a sleep disordered breathing type thing. It could be like a sleep apnea. Look to see if your baby is breathing with their mouth open or closed. The mouth should be closed and the lips should be sealed at night. The tongue should be resting on the roof of the mouth right behind the teeth. So that's one thing to look at. Tongue ties, lip ties are another thing. And sometimes these are like all related. I'm about to list off a bunch of things and they can be like their own individual issues with like specific causes, or they can all be like all be there together kind of in this big like muddled mess. Reflux is not a diagnosis. Reflux is a symptom. So make sure that if your baby has reflux, you are trying to advocate for them and maybe finding a holistic doctor who will help you, because I know most pediatricians won't. I already said mouth breathing. Food sensitivities is one. And I think I named all of the big things, but those are just some red flags to look out for and some things to explore if you are noticing some of those red flags. Do you have any questions about that? Because I want to make sure that that was really clear, because I think that's super important. And I don't know if I laid that out very clearly.
No, I think that was fantastic. I'm glad you remembered to bring it back up.
Yeah. I mean, I'm even going back to my own story. I was not aware of oral restrictions for the first like 18 months of my son's life. And he was waking up all the time. Yeah. And I wish I had had that education of knowing that there actually could be underlying reasons if your kids are waking up. So he was probably waking up every 30 minutes to an hour up until 18 mm-hmm. months, whether it's nighttime or nap time. And looking back on that, I'm like, how did I survive? And then number two, how did I not have an awareness? But that's okay. That's why we have those conversations now on a platform like this, to be able to mm-hmm. bring that awareness to moms. But yeah, I thought that was well said.
And I would also just say, listen to your gut, because you know if something is not right with your baby. Like if they're waking every 3 hours and they're calm and they're easy to settle, like that's totally normal. Even if they're sleeping with you, like I said, and waking every like 2 hours to nurse, but they're going right back to sleep and they're only latching for a couple of minutes, maybe, like that can be a super normal pattern. But like I had this with my son, actually. He's still not always the best sleeper because we're still working through issues with him, but he had ties and he mouth breathed and he had reflux and food sensitivities. And he had all of the things. And even after we began addressing them, like this can be a really long road, because even after he got the phrenectomy, and you know, I didn't know as much as I know now about it. And I wish that I had had him have body work before the phrenectomy, but I didn't. Anyways, I didn't. But know that the release, like specifically when we're talking about oral ties, the release doesn't fix things. The release only addresses the anatomy, but it doesn't address the functional issues that have developed because of that anatomy. And so a lot of, like, even if you have a pediatrician or a dentist or somebody who is willing to do a release or willing to take a tongue tie seriously, a lot of them don't understand the importance of ongoing care and therapy and body work. And so that is a huge piece to that. So I'm saying that because my son still mouth breathes and we're still working through that with a myofunctional therapist. My daughter mouth breathes too. She also has a tie that might need to be released, but we're going through therapy first. But he, the first 5 to 6 months of his life, he was literally up every 30 minutes and was restless and would not sleep next to me in bed, would not sleep unless he was elevated. Most of the time he would not sleep unless I was standing up rocking him. So it was absolutely a nightmare. Like talk about sleep deprivation. I feel like I totally have empathy and compassion for parents who are going through this because I've been through it. But that is a clear sign that this is not normal. This is not right. Your baby should be able to sleep soundly in between feeds, for the most part, except for those short periods of time where they might be going through some sort of progression, maybe a leap, maybe teething, something like that. So always just listen to your gut.
Yeah, I want to add one more thing on what you just said, because that's so profound for people to know the like standard and like what is biologically appropriate. And I love that that's why you educate moms on this, because I can't even count how many conversations that I've had where someone will like learn about co-sleeping or bed sharing from something I've posted. And they're like, well, I wish bed sharing worked for us, but my child only, you know, like my child wouldn't do it. They're just not a co-sleeper. They're not like a bed sharer. They needed to be to sleep on like an elevated surface. And that is exactly why this conversation is important, because it's not necessarily that the baby was not quote unquote a co-sleeper. It's that physiologically at that point in their time, there was something that was getting in the way. And so expanding our awareness of that is what is so cool about being able to like learn as we go. And I mean, you just talked about it with the frenectomy conversation. Like we all are like learning as we go. And that is a beautiful part of motherhood.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just was going to have us come back, Taylor. I'm super glad you remembered to finish out the red flags conversation. And I would love to also still, you know, hear your answer on how we can help holistically support mom and baby in sleep.
Yeah, for sure. So you talked about nutrition. That's a huge piece of it. You know, if you're not nourished, if you're, especially as a breastfeeding postpartum mom who is recovering from childbirth, sometimes recovering from a major abdominal surgery, you're going to be exhausted regardless of how much sleep you get, to be honest. And I will just say that, you know, going, like I've told you both kind of both of my sleep journeys with my first child and with my second, and my second has slept like exponentially worse than my first. And I have had less overall sleep deprivation and exhaustion with him, because I'm nourishing my body better. And also because my mindset has changed. I understand that I don't need to sleep train him and that I'm doing exactly what I need to do by supporting him through his struggles and, all of that. And so it can make such a huge difference. We should never underestimate the difference that, things outside of sleep make for exhaustion and for sleep deprivation, because it really does. Light. So getting a lot of preferably natural sunlight in the morning and afternoon. Light is what regulates our circadian rhythm. So like I was locked in a dark nursery all day with my first child. That certainly was not helping my circadian rhythm. So get outside, get fresh air, get sunlight, open the windows as soon as you get up in the morning. If you can, take a walk with your baby in the morning. That will help your circadian rhythm regulate. And then dimming the lights at night. So lighting is huge. Artificial lights are huge. It's a major disruptor of sleep. There is research that shows that blue light specifically can negatively impact melatonin production in our body for up to 2 hours. And so what that means is if you're scrolling your phone as you're about to go to sleep in the next 30 minutes, or even if you're laying in bed trying to go to sleep, you're signaling to your brain that you don't need to produce melatonin because it is not bedtime. You don't need to feel sleepy. Because if you think about it, you know, our ancestors, they didn't have electricity. They didn't have light. So their circadian rhythm was just regulated by natural light. The sun rose, they're awake. As the sun goes down, their body starts to produce melatonin and they get sleepy. Now we kind of have it all jacked up because we have bright lights on all evening and all night. And it's not giving our body the chance to regulate our circadian system, our circadian rhythm to regulate very well. And that's causing such huge sleep problems. So dimming lights, using like red, orange lights, if you need to use lights, like red night lights, salt lamps, those sorts of things. Using blue light blocking glasses, if you need to be on your phone or electronics or have bright lights on or whatever. And this is true of your baby too. So all of these things also apply to your baby. Your baby needs that bright light, that not bright artificial light, but natural sunlight in the morning and afternoon. They need the lights dim in the evening to help with their circadian rhythm. You know, when you're putting them down at night, pay attention to, are you scrolling your phone and can they see that light and is it impacting them? So think about things like with the environment, you know, make sure that the temperature is low enough, you know, cool enough in your house that you know, they say there's kind of a lot of different ranges, but I usually say like 68 to 72 degrees is a good sleeping temperature. Some people will say cooler. But the point is that you don't want it to be too warm because that can also disrupt your body's ability to go to sleep. And going to bed earlier. So, you know, and this is kind of comes back to that bottom layer of that pyramid, where what can we do to support ourselves and optimize our sleep that isn't necessarily changing anything about our baby? So one of those things is getting sleep when you can get it, when you have the opportunity. And so going to bed a little bit earlier. And I know that that's not necessarily like convenient for a lot of moms. And I also know that like, it can be really nice to stay up late and kind of feel like an adult, again, when, and, you know, not just be with a baby and like watch TV or read your books or whatever. But then you have to think about what is the consequence of that. So if your baby is still very wakeful throughout the night and you know you're going to be up all night, I think that's just for most women, if you're really struggling with sleep, that's just a sacrifice that you have to make to get enough sleep, is maybe going to bed with your baby, going to bed earlier, or at least just watching what time you go to bed. So you're not going to bed at 11 p.m. or midnight or something like this. One of my favorite strategies to help with this is I call it front loading your day. So if you have a list of things that you need to do in the evening, maybe to get ready for work the next day or daycare or, you know, whatever your life looks like. If you can, doing them earlier in the day. So even if that's like when you come home from work, doing that, having them done, or having your partner help you with those things if you need support, because what that does is it kind of frees up that evening where most moms, you know, they may put their baby to sleep and then they're rushing around the house trying to do all of the chores and get all the things ready. But instead, you already have that list pretty much done, so you can get ready for bed with your baby. And you don't necessarily have to go to sleep right then, but at least you're ready. You've gone through your bedtime routine, you've washed your face, whatever you do. And so that way, when you start to feel sleepy, you can just go to bed and you don't have this long list of things that you have to do before you go to bed. And with that, I would also say, make sure you're prioritizing. So does everything on that list need to be done? Do you need to clean the floors every night? Can you move something to another day? Can you meal prep on the weekends and make lunches on the weekends, like on a Saturday or Sunday, so that you don't have to do that every evening? So just thinking about things like that can be really helpful. Getting those external supports. What can your spouse help you with? What can he step up and do that you don't need to do? Can he pack your lunches? Can he change his schedule? Does he have a flexible schedule at work where maybe he can go in a little bit earlier in the morning? This is what my husband has always done, and it's been great. Going in a little bit earlier in the morning so that he gets off earlier in the evening, because he knows that that's when I'll need his support. And then I can go take a nap or just go do something for myself. So I talked about the main things. The other thing I would say is Wi-Fi, turning off the Wi-Fi at night can also make a really big difference. And just try it. If you don't already, just try that, because that can be super helpful. Making sure that your phone is on airplane mode, preferably out of your room, not having a lot of electronics in your room, because the EMF from that stuff really does impact sleep as well. And so those are like simple things that you can do really without much effort at all.
Fallon, what is the name of your EMF meter, by the way, that you got?
Oh man, I just got, you mean the, got, yeah, just my reader is like something I got off Amazon that just had good reviews.
Yeah, because I think that even like piggybacking off of that, you might think of phones or Wi-Fi as like the main source of EMFs, but there's so much more that can. And like, and then
sound machines.
Of
this whole conversation.
Like everything. And so yeah, even if that means getting like just throwing out the, I know. Here it's out of like necessity, but like we had sound machines back when we lived on the mainland. And then when we came here and don't have AC, we have just like really loud fans. And so that's been what has created like a little bit of white noise if my daughter's like napping during the day. But that might be an option, is like just, you know, switching out the white noise with fans if those are also low in EMFs. But that, all of that was just so good. I mean, Taylor's page is a wealth of knowledge when it comes to this. She also has a podcast. And I would love to hear what you would prefer when people get in touch with you, or where do you like people to start when they are new to your page and information?
Oh yeah, that's a great question. My Instagram account is where I'm at mostly for social media. And I have a lot of highlights. I have I think it's called Welcome. Yeah. A Welcome highlight. That's a good place to start, just to kind of tell you about myself and how I like to be communicated with. I usually prefer emails. I don't really answer a whole lot of DMs. I just don't really have the time to do that, but just kind of browsing my page, browsing my highlights. I also have some freebies that are linked in my bio, like, so the link in bio on my Instagram account. So those are also really good starting places, because those are packed with, I think there's two of them and they're packed with information. So that's a good start. And then my podcast too is another really good source of free information. I get asked questions all the time. And like 50% of the time I'm like directing people to this podcast episode or this freebie or, and so it's really nice when people just, go and look at that stuff first. Of course, I'm happy to answer questions, but a lot of that information is there for you. Yeah. Yeah. So that was a great question. Thank you for asking that.
Yeah. That's amazing. Taylor, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This was an incredible episode. You are just a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. And I can see as someone who owns one of your sleep courses, they're fantastic, totally worth it. So definitely go find Taylor on Instagram, go listen to her podcast, sort through all of her stuff. Thank you guys for listening. And thank you, Taylor, so much for being here. We'll see you guys next time.
Thank you for having me.